Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Not that you need reminding, but the 2020 election is now less than a month away. Yesterday, the two contenders for Vice President of the United States took to the stage at Kingsbury Hall at the University of Utah to make their case to the American public about the future of the country. Today on the show, and next week as well, actually, we're going to focus on the future of the state of Utah by spotlighting some of the candidates for statewide office. Today, you'll hear from two Democrats, gubernatorial candidate Chris Peterson and Attorney General candidate Greg Scordis. Next week, if everything goes to plan, you will hear from the Republican contenders in those same races. But without further ado, we kick off today's show with the minority party contender for governor, a seat a Utah Democrat hasn't won since 1980. Chris Peterson, Democratic candidate in the race for governor in Utah. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, hey, Roger, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on KCPW, and I'm excited to share a bit about my campaign with your listeners.
You know, you are a lawyer. You are considered an expert in consumer protection and a crusader against predatory lending. You know, in a minute, we will dig into some specific policies and where you stand on them. But I'm wondering if you first wouldn't mind telling us why you decided to run for governor. Was there a specific factor or set of factors that motivated you to join this race, Chris Peterson?
Well, you know, I'll be candid. I worked in the Obama administration and felt like we had some great experiences really making a difference in people's lives. I love teaching and being a law professor, but the Democratic Party approached me and encouraged me to run. Initially, I just chuckled and firmly showed them the door of my office because I'm not naive about what a challenge this is. But I've spent my entire career, as you pointed out, trying to make a difference in this world, whether that's in teaching my students and trying to be a good mentor or in my public service work with the federal government or in consumer advocacy organizations or just in lawsuits that I've worked in, and trying to make a difference in the daily lives of ordinary people. And as I thought about it, I realized that, look, this is an opportunity to raise some of the challenges that we face in this state. We're doing a lot of things right here in Utah, but we have some areas for improvement, and we need people to come forward and fight to try to make a difference in people's lives. And that's what I'm excited to do. It's an honor to serve the people of Utah and to help try to have a conversation in our state about the direction forward for Utahns.
I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of your biographical details. Like, you know, what is your background? You mentioned the Obama administration. I know it's with the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and that you have legal expertise in that field. I'll cut myself off there and have you just tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you?
Well, my deep Utah roots, my great-great-grandfather led a wagon train of 1,500 pioneers to the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. He became the public school superintendent, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the first chairman of Zions Bank, and the third president of the LDS Church. But I myself came from much more humble roots. I was raised in West Valley City by my single disabled mom. And, you know, we had very, very limited income when I was a kid. Some of my earliest memories were pushing my mom in her wheelchair in the grocery store. Got my first job when I was about 10 years old, picking up trash outside of a strip mall along 3500 South. For those of you that know the West Side, very busy corridor in our state. I worked my way through high school and college and swept the halls at the University of Utah trying to pay my way through college, eventually won a scholarship to go to law school. And somewhere along there, I decided that I wanted my life to be about public service. I turned down jobs at fancy law firms and banks, but instead I wanted to teach and serve. I just have never really cared that much about making money. I care about people. I care about making a difference in this life. And that's what I've been trying to do my entire career. You mentioned the Obama administration. I'd been writing about expensive mortgage loans that were risky for people. And after the crash in 2008, I'd written some stuff about Lehman Brothers. And so the folks that were setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that's the new agency they created after the crash, recruited me to come back east and help set up the law enforcement office of the CFPB. My job was to help design enforcement cases against banks and debt collectors who broke the law, took advantage of their customers. And we managed to return about $12 billion in refunds and restitution to Americans all across the country. And I also had been working on trying to make sure in particular that our military service members and their families are protected from predatory loans. And the Pentagon, you know, asked me to come over and help lead their efforts to try to pass some rules to make it illegal to make predatory payday loans to our active duty service members. I'm very proud that the Secretary of Defense gave me an award for accomplishing that mission. It's now illegal to make a payday loan to any soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine in our country. It's something I'm proud of. And it's the same kind of energy and spirit that I want to bring to the race here in Utah. Identify problems and then work hard, compromise, find solutions, and make a difference.
I want to come back to you know, the problems that you'd like to see fixed, but I do want to dive into something that is very much in the present moment and in the minds of many listeners, which is the pandemic. Utah and, of course, you know, the nation and the rest of the world, we're experiencing this crisis brought on by the pandemic. Your opponent is the guy who is in charge of the task force leading efforts on this here in Utah. You've been critical of the state's response on the pandemic to some extent. Maybe you could tell us where were the stumbles and what would you have done different than what the state has done so far?
Well, it's a great question. A lot of things. You know, on my website, we have an 11-point plan that I've come up with in consultation with medical experts and scientists of things that we need to be doing differently to try to get this crisis under control. First off, I want to make sure your listeners know that this is a serious crisis. Many of our friends and neighbors are not convinced that this is the crisis that it is, but over 200,000 people have perished. That's more people than died in all of our wars and combat operations since the Second World War combined, including Korea and Vietnam and all the Middle Eastern wars. We haven't been having as high of fatality rates here in Utah, mostly because we have a young population, but hundreds of people are dying, more than all of our traffic accidents combined. COVID is now the third leading cause of death in America, only behind cancer and heart disease. But it's an infectious disease that spreads easily. And our numbers, our transmission rates are out of control. I'm very concerned that we're going to see hundreds and hundreds more Utahns dying. We've got to do better first. We need to make sure we have a statewide mask mandate with reasonable exceptions. Nobody's saying if you're a rancher out in 40 acres that you have to wear a mask. But if you can't maintain social distance, you need to have a mask on. Second, processing our tests is still taking 72 hours, 4 days, 5 days a week. And many people are struggling to figure out where to go and whether or not they qualify to get tested. We need testing for anybody who is willing to take a test. And we need that turnaround time to be 24 hours or less for in all circumstances, because we've got to get this virus under control. Third, we need to get contact tracing up and running in a much more aggressive way. We need to triple or even quadruple the number of contact tracers to track down people who are getting infected. Last thing I'll mention, fourth, we've wasted a lot of time, resources, and money on protective technologies that aren't actually working. We had a big fight about hydroxychloroquine, which has there's no scientific evidence it does any good. We bought a cell phone app for millions and millions of dollars that could have been used to keep open three low-income health clinics that are currently in the process of being shut down by the state and could be leveraged to try to improve our COVID response. And many people still can't get access to the best quality protective equipment like N95 respirator masks, goggles. Our frontline workers, not just in the medical profession, but grocery store clerks and restaurant workers, meat packing plants, other manufacturing facilities need the highest quality protective gear. I have a number of other practical suggestions we've got to get on, but none of these things are being accomplished. And look, it's killing people. What more of a serious of a crisis could we be facing? We've got to take action immediately to protect our neighbors.
I'm wondering if some of the actions that you described there, particularly on things like the contracts for technology that you know didn't do what the state hoped that they would do. I mean, is there a little bit of charitable interpretation there where we were trying to do whatever we could and this was an unprecedented situation? And so, look, we just, you know, we spent the money on the wrong things, but it was all well-intentioned?
Well, look, there's no question in my mind that the lieutenant governor and the governor are well-intentioned. Look, I personally like them. I think they're nice guys. I would love to go bowling or, you know, whatever. But I'm not ascribing bad intent. But we also have a responsibility in government to take care of the taxpayers' funds. And the state auditor, who's a Republican, of course, issued a report saying that there were serious concerns with the way that the money was managed and that there were very close ties and relationships between some of the companies that had contracts steered to them by the lieutenant governor in particular. That's not the way that we do purchasing in our society. Normally there's a whole procurement process. Maybe we need to have some abbreviated version of that for an emergency, but that doesn't mean that you can pick out your friends and steer lucrative government contracts to them. And look, even if all of it was right in the first instance, the simple fact is that, especially on that cell phone app, we're still paying $10,000 a day in licensing fees for this app that's not providing the services of contact tracing that we were originally promised. We need to stop the bleeding, and then we need an attorney general investigation, a civil investigation, to figure out whether or not we can get the taxpayers their money back. Look, this is not personal. It's about doing the public's business, making sure that the money is appropriately, and that we're taking all the steps we need to keep the public safe and get our economy back on track.
On the mask mandate, something I'm sure a number of listeners keyed in on, they heard you say statewide mask mandate. Could you not expect, if you were to have done that, or if Governor Gary Herbert were to have done that, a sizable backlash given what we've seen? And would that have possibly canceled out the intended good of the statewide mask mandate? Do you know what I mean? Like, is there a sort of delicate game that our politicians are playing?
Well, it's an interesting question. What we need right now is teamwork. Over 20 states have imposed statewide mask mandates, and virtually every country that's been successful, and more successful than us in getting their epidemic under control, has had much more aggressive mask requirements than our state has. And remember, it's not that the virus is now all over the state. There is no area in our state that's not at risk. And we need to do this because it's how we take care of each other. I'm sure that there are going to be people who disagree. And I love them. I care about them. I respect their views. But frankly, they're wrong. The science is what needs to guide us in this situation, not the fringe politics or internet memes or conspiracy theories. We need somebody who listens to scientific expertise, and the science is now unequivocal. There is overwhelming evidence that for this particular virus, wearing a mask, especially a high-quality filtering mask, protects yourself and also the people around you. And that's why we've got to take steps to implement a mask mandate.
We could spend the entirety of this interview on the pandemic, and we're running low on time. I want to probe, some of the other ways that you'd like to affect change here in Utah if elected. And this next question often gets framed as kind of a, I don't know, challenges that the future holds question. Instead of doing that, I want to ask about the problems that you see in the state right now that you think are the biggest current issues in Utah that you would seek to fix if elected. It may be top two or three things to prevent a laundry list. Chris Peterson.
Well, so it's a tough question to answer because I think there are a lot of challenges. Maybe I'll just say one that I think cuts across the top of all of them. We've had a hard time getting our government to listen to the public. I think our government is becoming much, much more conservative than the mainstream Utahns are. You just look at the last election and the public passed ballot measures on Medicaid expansion, medical marijuana under physicians' orders, and then also a fair elections anti-gerrymandering initiative, only to see our state legislature water down and replace all three of those ballot measures with much weaker, more problematic rules. And they speak to some of the great challenges of our time, whether that's opioid addiction, access to healthcare, and also revitalizing the democratic process, all things I care a lot about. And the public is doing the right thing on it, only to see that their elected officials walking it back and trying to push for the status quo. I will protect propositions, and I'll do it in those three areas, but I also want you to know that I'm going to be fighting for working people in this state. More access to affordable health care, more access to affordable housing, and then also taking on the greatest challenge we're not going to have nearly enough time to talk about in the long-term future is climate change. It's going to change the way that we have to live our lives, our businesses, our lifestyles. We are facing a serious existential crisis in the human species and right here in Utah, and need to make progress on the challenge of climate change.
There's so much more I'd like to get into with you, and we are basically at the end of the interview. You know, you mentioned the overriding of the will of the people that is frequently talked about with the changes to ballot initiatives. Is there, and this is sort of a philosophical question, and maybe we'll just end here, but are there instances in which the people are wrong? You know, I think that sometimes the lawmakers justify the changes they make by suggesting that they have greater expertise than the people themselves. Is that true sometimes?
Well, it certainly can be. I mean, I recognize that we have representative democracy for a reason, and sometimes you need some experts to sort things out. But what I will press back on is that the public were not wrong in any one of those three ballot measures. And I know because I'm, you know, reasonably good lawyer, and I went through, dug into them and figured it out. And the ballot measures were better than the rules that replaced them. And the reason that they were being replaced is not because the state legislature had more expertise, but because they were trying to preserve the status quo in one ballot measure in particular, their own power. And that's not okay. We're supposed to have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not a government of the people by special interests, privileged insiders, or party elites. And that's a real difference between myself and my opponent, who is an upstanding good man, but I didn't come up through a party system and get handpicked by the previous governor. I came to every measure of success that I've had in my career by working hard, trying to be a good team player, trying to listen to expertise and be thoughtful and make a difference in the lives of ordinary Utahns. For folks that are out there listening, if you're ready for a change and want a reasonable moderate who will try to keep the things in Utah that are going well the same, but try to make progress on areas of improvement, I hope that you'll give me your vote this coming election.
Chris Peterson is the Democratic candidate in the race for governor in the state of Utah. Thank you so much for making time for this today.
Roger, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Again, you're listening to In the Hive on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. A reminder that we're featuring conversations with candidates for statewide office this week and next. Now we turn to the Democrat running against the incumbent Republican seeking re-election as state attorney general. And we'll dive right into my conversation with Democrat Greg Skordas. Greg Skordas is the Democratic candidate for Utah attorney general. And Greg Skordas, thank you very much for making time for this.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
You know, it's tough in these candidate interviews to balance the need for biography from the candidate who is not the incumbent with the need to hear about policy priorities, about the work that you want to do. I think a number of our listeners will know some of your biography, but, you know, many others will not. So just to begin with, tell us a little bit about yourself and your work in the law.
Sure. So the brief bio of myself is I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law since 1982. My wife, Rebecca, and I live in Weber County. I have three adult children. My son's a medical doctor, orthopedic surgeon in the United States Air Force. My oldest daughter is a grade school teacher in Meridian, Idaho. And my baby daughter is an environmental scientist living in Maine. I started practicing law in 1982. I actually had an undergraduate degree in, of all things, metallurgical engineering. And I went to law school to be a mining and patent lawyer, but instead sort of fell in love with the criminal practice, started my career at the Salt Lake Legal Defenders Association, representing indigents, went to the Salt Lake District Attorney's Office, where I was a prosecuting attorney for 8 years. I was Utah's first gang prosecutor. I prosecuted Utah's first DNA case. I later became the chief of the sex crimes unit. It was called the Special Victims Unit. And then left that office in 1994, started my own law firm where I've practiced ever since. I'm currently the attorney for the Utah Rape Recovery Center. I'm an attorney for the Utah Crime Victims Legal Clinic. I do a lot of victim advocacy as sort of a pro bono project that I do, and do a fair amount of criminal defense work. I also represent two of the largest police unions in the state, the Utah Highway Patrol Association, and I'm one of the attorneys for the Fraternal Order of Police. Just one last bio piece that if I could have the time, Roger. In 1995, I was part of a very small group of lawyers, three of us, that brought the drug court concept to Utah. I'm very proud of that, and it's one of the things that I mentioned because we did a lot of innovative things when I was with the gang unit in terms of, you know, the Serious Youth Offender Act and things like that. When I was with the Sex Crimes Unit, the Victims' Bill of Rights, But the drug court concept has really been huge, and it's something that I'm very proud of. In fact, I operate a nonprofit which is designed to really as an aftercare for drug court graduates, for kids that get out of that system, and just to provide them some sort of ongoing way to deal with their peers, a way to stay involved with the drug court. We found that drug court was great. It had huge success, but 2 or 3 years later, people were falling off. So we've sort of made it a lifetime endeavor if they do want to get involved in that. So yeah, I've really been proud of that as well.
You know, I imagine that we will circle back to some of those points from your resume as we proceed. But, you know, the Attorney General, that title is often referred to as the top law enforcement official in the state. If you were to win this election, you'd be in charge of what is essentially Utah's largest law firm, a firm with investigatory powers. You would make decisions about those investigations and who gets prosecuted. And of course, you would have an advisory role on the making of laws themselves, the, you know, defending or not defending challenges to Utah law, among a variety of other responsibilities. I guess with all of that said, what would be your philosophy as Attorney General of the state of Utah?
So first of all, that was kind of a mouthful of a question, but it was a fair question. I sort of don't like the title Utah's top cop. And in fact, I think that attorneys general are not cops at all. I've taught 400 hours at Utah's Police Academy, and I don't even consider myself the top cop in this building. But I do think that the Attorney General has a prosecutorial role. I think it's important to point out that there is currently no candidate for Attorney General who has ever, besides myself, prosecuted so much as a speeding ticket. And I prosecuted everything from drunk drivers to first-degree murders. Neither of the opponents currently running for Attorney General can say that. And so when you talk about the prosecutorial and investigative role of the AG's office, I think I bring some experience to that. And it's important because when I worked at the district attorney's office, when we were deciding cases to file or how to charge cases, or even just the simple, how can we plea bargain this case? It was helpful to have had that experience. And we don't have that in the AG's office right now. We don't have any prosecutorial experience with the AG. I don't believe he's ever stood in front of a Utah jury on any kind of a case or even any jury at all. So I think that experience is helpful. The sort of the secondary part of your question is, when do we get involved in other litigation? And I sort of look to the will of the people. I'll give you one example and I'll try to make it short. But the Utah voters went to the ballot box in 2018 and they passed three propositions, voter initiatives. Prop 3, I'll just give you an example, would have expanded Medicaid to an additional 102,000 Utahns at the cost to the taxpayer of 15 cents per $100 spent in retail. 100,000 Utahns now would get medical coverage. Our Attorney General has completely ignored that. And that's when you say top cop, really the Attorney General is the top lawyer for the people. He's completely ignored the will of the people. And to go further, he's joined a lawsuit with about a dozen other attorneys general nationwide, which if successful, would not only take Utahns out of that expanded Medicaid, but it would do away entirely with the Affordable Care Act. And to me, that's just inexcusable in a pandemic. It's inexcusable when you look at what Utah voters have told the legislature and the Attorney General their desires are. That was a bipartisan initiative. It was a majority of Utahns, neither Republican nor Democrat initiative, and they voted to expand Medicaid, and we're not doing it.
Well, and that's on that ballot initiative. I think that Reyes has said, and or maybe his surrogates have said, that, you know, signing on to that challenge to the Affordable Care Act is because it's an unconstitutional law, in his words, and that it isn't, you know, that the law itself isn't popular among Utahns. So he's doing the people's bidding, basically. I mean, there's likely more to his arguments than that, but...
But that's just not true. That's just not true. Their argument is that it's an illegal taxation. So if it is... Let's see your alternative. And if the will of the people doesn't express the will of the people, the ballot initiative, which was passed by 53% of the voters, if that's not enough to tell you as an attorney general what the people want, then I don't know what else you could learn. But Utah voters support and Utahns support increased Medicaid. They support affordable health care. And in a pandemic, they support it more than ever. And our attorney general is, in my opinion, basically is thumbing his nose at the Utah voters. And it's costing us millions of dollars. It's costing us millions of dollars in federal aid.
Can I ask, you're describing these, I guess, as political, maybe politically minded decisions.
No question.
And I guess here's what I want to, you know, on the topic of politics and the law, you know, we have the idea that the attorney general has these investigative duties and can charge whomever they like or conceivably not charge whoever they like. And they also receive political contributions, you know, campaign contributions. Is that something that is appropriate for this office? And how do you handle that in your own campaign, Greg Skordas?
It's absolutely inappropriate. And our attorney general has done it over and over and over. I'll just give you one example. And I have a dozen. There's a company called Washakie Chemical, which was a fraudulent renewable energy company, completely fraudulent. They stole $500 million in tax credits from Utah and national taxpayers. They paid our attorney general $51,000. Now, you'll have to ask him what the attorney general would do with $51,000 from a renewable energy company, but I'll tell you what he did with it. He put it in his campaign pocket. He spent it all, even though he misled the public about that and said he was going to return it. And he didn't charge this fraudulent energy company for all of the fraudulent acts that they were doing. The United States attorney doesn't take payoffs, doesn't take $51,000, doesn't take campaign contributions, indicted the company. Five of its members are currently in federal prison, not from the Utah Attorney General's office. He took his $51,000 and ran. The U.S. Attorney's office took it. So campaign finance in this state, and there are Democrats who benefit from it as well, is off the charts bad, and we need to reel it in. We have probably 10 times the number of donors that our opponent does, and we've probably raised a third as much money. We're not taking $50,000, $60,000, contributions. We're taking nickels and dimes, and we need to approach the legislature with real, honest campaign finance and say there should be limits. The feds do it. Local municipalities like Salt Lake City, they do it. So the state ought to be doing it as well instead of just these completely unlimited contributions.
What about the idea? Do you have any thoughts on whether the AG should be elected at all as opposed to appointed in a handful of U.S. states? You know, the governor appoints the attorney general.
I don't think it should be appointed. But having said that, I don't think it should be a partisan election. I don't think Republican or Democrat or Libertarian should play into the attorney general race at all. It's an attorney position. It's not a political position. I don't think that the governor should be allowed to just appoint his or her own attorney general. That doesn't make sense either. The people have a right to some say in that. But if I were king for a day, I would say the attorney general race is one of the races that should be nonpartisan, like some of our municipal, like mayor's races are typically nonpartisan.
Changing topics kind of wildly here, but in the interest of time, Mr. Skordas, you mentioned earlier your role in the Salt Lake County Drug Court. That initiative, the drug court, is part of an overarching rubric of criminal justice reform. What is the state attorney general's role in that concept, in criminal justice reform, and how would you do it different than the way it's being done now if you were elected?
So I'm not sure that they're doing anything now, but what I would do is what I've done, what my history shows. And drug court, just so you know, has been expanded to veterans court. It's been expanded to mental health court. It's been expanded to virtually every single county in the state. And it's helped those three courts, probably 10,000 Utahns, get out of whatever problems they were dealing with. That's justice reform. That's criminal justice reform. And that's something I'm very proud to be at the forefront of and something that we would continue. I think the attorney general has a duty to keep on top of those things and to propose those type of things to the legislature and to say, look, if we really want to make a dent in crime, rather than just building more prisons and immediately filling them up, let's consider some alternatives. And the legislature has, by and large, listened to those things when the AG has taken them to the legislature, but our current attorney general just hasn't done it. I mean, we haven't decriminalized drugs, but we've made the simple possession of drugs, and this was something I have to applaud the Republican legislature, into a misdemeanor, so that we're recognizing that simple users don't need to be slapped with a felon the rest of their life. Dealers should, manufacturers should. I completely understand that. But if we want to stop drug addiction, drug court and therapy, and jumping in early makes a lot more sense than throwing somebody in jail for 6 months and hoping that a miracle will happen and they'll simply walk out of jail no longer an addict. That just doesn't happen.
There's so much that we have not gotten to, you know, for example, the seemingly somewhat sordid history of the office and allegations of pay for play for prior attorneys general. But we are nearly out of time. And so, Greg Skordas, I'll let you just sort of summarize for us again who you are and make your pitch directly to the voters for why they ought to vote for you.
So I think you summed it up very well. That office needs to have its integrity restored. I mean, it's not well respected by our judiciary and by our state bar and even by law enforcement. It is pay for play, and it's been that way for 20 years. That needs to stop. And the attorney general, having been an attorney for 38 years and understanding the role of an attorney, it's to support your client. It's to meet with your client. And in that case, it's the people of the state of Utah, and honor their wishes, and not to simply tell them, oh, you can't do that, or oh, you can't do that, or oh, your Affordable Care Act law is dumb, we're not going to do it. But to say, look, here's a real alternative. If you really want to expand something, if you really want to do something, here's how to do it. And that's what a good attorney does. And that's not what we're getting at the attorney general's office. And the pay for play is frankly laughable. I mean, it's just, it breaks my heart in some respects, because that office is for sale and has been for 20 years. And it just has to stop, because it's not getting us anywhere. And in fact, we're going backwards with the number of people who can escape criminal prosecution, who deserve criminal prosecution, but can escape that simply by giving my opponent a check.
Greg Skordas is an attorney. He's the Democratic nominee for Attorney General on the November ballot. And Mr. Skordas, again, thank you very much for making time for this.
Hey, thanks for making time for me. I appreciate you very much.
That's it for In the Hive today. A reminder that you can get a full rundown of what's going to be on your ballot by visiting vote.utah.gov. Tune in next week for the Republican candidates in the race for governor and attorney general, if their schedules permit. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.